So far in this series, we have looked at Judges 1, verse 1 through Judges 2, verse 5, which we identified as an introduction to the book. It narrated a story of essential success in Israel taking the land, with some significant failures that fell short of full obedience to the Lord. In the first five verses of chapter 2, we saw the angel of Yahweh's evaluation of Israel's disobedience. Because Israel had failed fully to drive the inhabitants out of the land and had even made covenants with some of them, the angel of Yahweh, which he said is most likely the second person of the Trinity in angelic form, declared, "I will not drive them out before you, but they shall be thorns in your side, and their gods shall be a snare to you." This led the children of Israel to weep and to name the place Bochim, which means weepers. The rest of chapter 2 functions like a second introduction to the book of Judges, but rather than looking back, these verses look ahead to some of the things that will be narrated in detail throughout the book. It is like a summary in advance to let us know where the book of Judges will be taking us. And tonight we're going to look at chapter 2, verses 6 through 15, to identify one of the chief sources of Israel's failure and then its consequences. It is a failure that remains all too common in the church in our day, so it is important that we understand what these verses have to teach us. We're going to follow a two-part outline. First of all, look at the source of Israel's failure in verses 6 through 10, and then the consequences of Israel's failure in verses 11 through 15. We want to consider this as a history lesson that has much from which we can learn. We begin with the source of Israel's failure in verses 6 through 10. Verse 6, "And when Joshua had dismissed the people, the children of Israel went each to his own inheritance to possess the land." Now, this brief statement refers to what is recorded in Joshua 24, the dismissal of the tribes to their respective portions of the land after covenant renewal with Yahweh at Shechem. That covenant involved promises from the people to worship only Yahweh and also a warning to them about what would happen if they didn't. Joshua 24:20, "If you forsake Yahweh and serve foreign gods, then he will turn and do you harm and consume you after he has done you good." The people responded, "No, but we will serve Yahweh." And Joshua then declared, "You are witnesses against yourselves that you have chosen Yahweh for yourselves to serve him." So what Joshua is saying is the covenant to vow to serve Yahweh would be a witness against the people if they failed to fulfill that vow. The covenant held out promises of blessing on obedience, but also the potential of curses on covenantal disobedience. Israel understood this at Shechem. Verse 7, "So the people served Yahweh all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great works of Yahweh, which he had done for Israel." Now, this verse speaks both of Joshua and the elders who outlived Joshua. In other words, this was that generation who, we're told, had seen all the great works of Yahweh, which he had done for Israel. And during their lifetimes, the people served Yahweh. They had these eyewitnesses who could bear testimony to the Magnalia Dei, the great works of the Lord. And just as in Judges 1, the passage here gets off to a good start. Verses 8 to 9. "Now Joshua the son of Nun, the servant of Yahweh, died when he was 110 years old. And they buried him within the border of his inheritance at Timnath-Heres in the mountains of Ephraim on the north side of Mount Gaash." Now these verses also refer back to events recorded in Joshua 24, specifically those relating to the death and the burial of Joshua. And the wording of the two passages is almost identical, except for an interesting variation on the name of the place of Joshua's burial. Joshua 24:30 gives the name Timnath-Serah, while Judges 2:9 gives the name Timnath-Heres. Timnath-Serah means portion of abundance, while Timnath-Heres means portion of the sun. Now, these are two names for the same place, and they highlight two aspects of Yahweh's faithfulness to Israel. He was indeed the God of abundance, who had brought them into the land flowing with milk and honey. And he is also the God of the sun, and this is almost certainly a reference to his making the sun stand still to give Joshua and his forces victory over a confederacy of pagan kings at Gibeon, which we looked at in our study of Joshua in Joshua chapter 10. And so by speaking of portion of abundance, portion of the sun, these place names were meant to be instructive to the people, reminding them of the faithfulness and the power of their covenant God. Every time they would take these names upon their lips, if they had maps and back in those days, they would see the things on the maps, and those things were declaring the glory of God. But sadly, this instruction was not given from one generation to the next, as Yahweh intended and indeed commanded. Verse 10, when all that generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation arose after them who did not know Yahweh nor the work which he had done for Israel. And this is the great covenantal failure on the part of Israel. The faithful generation of Joshua's day did not train the next generation to know the Lord or his works so that they would walk in obedience to him. Now the language here is reminiscent to that of Exodus 1:8, where we read, now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. You see, the Egyptian pharaohs who knew Joseph and knew the blessings that he had brought to their nation treated the Israelites who dwelt in their land very well. But when a king arose who did not know Joseph, he enslaved them. Now that was a failure of memory outside of Israel, but here in Judges 2, we have a failure of memory inside of Israel, and it was absolutely devastating. Recall how the law placed great importance upon training each coming generation in the things of the Lord. In Deuteronomy 6, the giving of Israel's basic confession of faith, the Shema, is immediately followed by the command for parents to train up their children in the words of the Lord. Hear, O Israel, Yahweh our God, Yahweh is one. You shall love Yahweh your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorpost of your house and on your gates. The idea was that instruction about the things of the Lord was to be woven into the warp and woof of family life in Israel. Whether they were at home, sitting at home, whether they were out walking somewhere, it was time to speak of the Lord. Whether they were getting ready to go to bed at night or whether they had just arisen in the morning, it was time to speak of the Lord. The words of Yahweh were to be bound on their hands as frontlets between their eyes and on their doorpost, probably not to be taken literally, but symbolically saying that knowledge of the Lord was to pervade all of their life. And this is God's plan of covenantal succession, of the faith passing from one generation to the next. It is God's plan A for church growth. Now, it is wonderful when unbelievers convert to the faith and are added to the body of Christ, but I call that plan B. Plan A is for the children of believers to be nurtured in the faith from their earliest days and to grow up confessing the faith that they have been taught and have seen on display in the community of believers. Now, I remember as a teenager, they used to show us all these films about these awesome testimonies. You know, the biker gang dude who becomes a Christian, the drug addict who becomes a Christian, the murderer who becomes a Christian. And I used to think I was kind of a second-class Christian because I didn't have that kind of a testimony. Now, however, I believe it is a wonderful testimony to say, I never remember a time when I did not know and trust in the Lord. Because that is my testimony, growing up in a good Christian family and a Christian church. Not only was that my testimony, that was David's testimony, King David's testimony, recorded in Psalm 22, verses 9 and 10. He's speaking to the Lord and he says, but you are he who took me out of the womb. You made me trust while on my mother's breast. I was cast upon you from birth, from my mother's womb. You have been my God. And we should be reminded of this plan A for the church at every baptism of a covenant child here at Covenant Presbyterian Church. The third vow taken by the parents is to give a positive answer to these questions. It's kind of like one long question. Do you now unreservedly dedicate your child to God and promise an humble reliance upon divine grace that you will endeavor to set before him a godly example, that you will pray with and for him, that you will teach him the doctrines of our holy religion, and that you will strive by all the means of God's appointment to bring him up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord? And if your child or your grandchild was baptized in a PCA church, then you as parents, or you know the parents, vowed to do just that. And all it is essentially a promise to obey Deuteronomy 6 in a new covenant setting. But then, in our service of baptism, the congregation is asked to take a vow by answering this question in the affirmative. Do you, as a congregation, undertake the responsibility of assisting the parents in the Christian nurture of this child? So what happens at every covenant baptism should remind us that parents have the primary responsibility to teach the Christian faith to their children, and that church members are available to come alongside and to assist them in that great endeavor. Now, some parents get that backwards, thinking that they have done their duty if they just get their children to worship services and to Sunday school. Now, these are means of grace. They're very important. But they are not to take the place of daily nurture of children in the context of family life. What happens in a church building on Sunday is to be an addendum to what happens in Christian homes throughout the week. The great failure of the generation after Joshua in Israel was a failure to train up their children in the things of the Lord. It was a failure to obey the commands of Deuteronomy 6. It was to leave their children at the mercy of the Canaanite world around them. And we are reading a record of failure and condemnation when we read, "Another generation arose after them who did not know Yahweh, nor the work which he had done for Israel." Well, from that source of failure, we turn to consider consequences of Israel's failure, beginning at verse 11. What can we expect to happen when the content of reality of the faith are not passed on to the next generation? And that's what we find out now, verses 11 through 13. "Then the children of Israel did evil in the sight of Yahweh and served the Baals. And they forsook Yahweh, God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt. And they followed other gods from among the gods of the people who were all around them. And they bowed down to them. And they provoked Yahweh to anger. They forsook Yahweh and served Baal and the Ashtoreths." The first thing we're told about this generation who did not know Yahweh is that the children of Israel did evil in the sight of Yahweh and served the Baals. Now, note first of all that their evil was in the sight of Yahweh, in the sight of the Lord. Now, because they weren't thinking about him regularly, they might well have comforted themselves by thinking that if Yahweh existed, he was far away and had no concern for their activities. But that was not the case. God sees all, and his seeing involves evaluation. Think of the refrain throughout Genesis 1 that God saw what he had made and declared it good. What God sees the children of Israel doing, as recorded in Judges 2, will receive a very different evaluation. Now, one form of Israel's evils was that they served the Baals. Now, we've all heard of Baal. We recognize that this involves pagan worship, some kind of idolatry, but perhaps we don't really know the depths of depravity on display in Baal worship. So to get this before our minds, I want to read a summary by commentator Ralph Davis, with the caveat this is kind of PG-13 material, but this is what the Bible's talking about. "Baal was the god of storm and fertility. And for the Canaanites, of course, fertility was the name of the game. Fertility of crops and livestock and family. Baal, nature god that he was, naturally had his female consort, Ashtoreth or Ashtar. In Canaanite theology and agriculture, the fertility of the land depended upon the sexual relationship between Baal and his consort. The revival of nature was due to sexual intercourse between Baal and his partner. But the Canaanite faithful didn't simply sit back and say, let Baal do it. There was no let go and let Baal thinking among them. Instead, the watchword was, serve Baal with gladness, all ye glands. Hence, the Canaanites practiced sacred prostitution as a part of their worship. A Canaanite man, for instance, would go to a Baal shrine and have intercourse with one of the sacred prostitutes serving there. The man would fulfill Baal's role and the woman Ashtart's. The idea was that the copulating of the worshiper and the holy whore would encourage the divine couple, Mr. and Mrs. or Ms. Baal, to do their thing, and thus the rain, grain, wine, and oil would flow again. Now that's the nature of Baal worship. This was the alternative religion that was available to Israel. And you can see that when Israel served the Baals, they broke more than just the first commandment. Furthermore, to serve Baal was to make a choice against Yahweh. So we read, they forsook Yahweh, God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt. Note that we are not simply told they forsook God. No, they forsook Yahweh, the covenant name of the God of their fathers, the God who had delivered them from slavery in Egypt. How could they possibly make such a choice? Well, in part, it was because their parents had failed to instill in them a knowledge of Yahweh and his past works on behalf of Israel that would embolden this generation with the faith of their fathers. Failure of covenant training led to rank idolatry of the basest sort. But even Baal worship was not enough for them. We're told they followed other gods from among the gods of the people who were all around them, and they bowed down to them. The Israelites, you see, were equal opportunity idolaters, and they would serve whichever gods the inhabitants of the land worshipped. And the God who sees all and evaluates all has a response. They provoked Yahweh to anger. Now remember that covenant at Shechem. When they were told not to worship the gods of the people in the land, they responded, no, but we will serve Yahweh. Now their disobedience is bearing covenant testimony against them, and they become the subject of God's righteous anger. And in this, Yahweh is simply abiding by the terms of the covenant that Israel had entered into with him. In verse 13, we have a summary statement. They forsook Yahweh and served Baal and the Ashtoreths. Notice that when it comes to worship, it is either or, not both and. At various times in Israel's history, she thought she could worship Yahweh as well as Baal and other gods. But that is impossible. The only way to worship Baal is to forsake Yahweh. And this is just what they did. And we can say that the anger of Yahweh was not just in word, but in deed and in power, verses 14 and 15. And the anger of Yahweh was hot against Israel, so he delivered them into the hands of plunderers who despoiled them. And he sold them into the hands of their enemies all around, so that they could no longer stand before their enemies. Wherever they went out, the hand of Yahweh was against them for calamity, as Yahweh had said, and as Yahweh had sworn to them. And they were greatly distressed. Now remember, this is a preview about things we're going to be reading about in Judges. Again and again, we will see Israelite unfaithfulness followed by defeat at the hands of their enemies. But this was not a series of random events. We read, wherever they went out, the hand of Yahweh was against them for calamity, as Yahweh had said, and as Yahweh had sworn to them. You see, what we need to remember about the God of the covenant is that he is faithful not only in covenant blessings, but in covenant curses. Israel receives nothing from the hand of God that is out of accord with the covenant that he has made with them. They had promised, we will serve Yahweh. And when they broke that promise, they brought covenant curses upon themselves. They should have known better. But again, there was a failure to train up the next generation in the faith, and the consequences were spiritually disastrous. In 1 Corinthians 10, Paul relates some of the story of Israel's history, and then he writes, now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the end of the ages has come. In other words, we are supposed to learn practical lessons for our lives from the old covenant history that we have recorded in the Old Testament. And in the case of Judges 2, we should certainly learn the importance of the spiritual nurture of our covenant children. One thing this passage shows is that every generation of Christians is potentially one generation away from apostasy. And I really think we need to believe every generation of Christians is potentially one generation away from apostasy. That's what we saw in Judges. You need but look at the history of mainline denominations in our nation over the past 120 years to see this in action. As trust in Scripture and belief in the gospel was abandoned, once flourishing worship was replaced by mere social gatherings with a religious veneer. And sadly, what one can hear in many pulpits in our nation today differs little from what one hears from mainstream media outlets. These churches have chosen Baal over Yahweh. But this happens not only on a denominational or a congregational level, but also on a family level. Indeed, if families would remain true to the faith once for all delivered to the saints, there would be no denominational decline in their churches because they wouldn't allow it. The scriptural picture reflected in our baptismal vows is of families raising their children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord with the church supporting them. Now, I don't want to downplay the importance of the local church in the religious training of our children, so don't mishear me. Corporate worship should be a priority. It should be a highlight of the week for our families. And if we don't view it that way, and if children see that, then what message are we sending to our children? But what do you think will happen if we leave our children at the mercy of the world for 6 days each week? Will a few hours on Sunday morning counteract such worldly influence? God is gracious. He can do things above and beyond what we expect, but I don't think we should expect that to be the case if this is what happens. Our homes need to be incubators of faith in which God is honored daily in word and deed. That can happen formally, at mealtime prayers and daily family devotions. It can happen informally, as parents model Christian living imperfectly but sincerely, and as the Lord and His works naturally become regular subjects of conversation. You see, we live in God's world, so there's no lack of subject matter for us in obeying Deuteronomy 6. The good news is that God is gracious and could bless our children through our imperfect efforts, and I, for one, am very thankful of that, being very imperfect in my efforts as a father. But we should not presume upon divine grace to justify our ongoing disobedience. Whether you are a parent who has vowed to bring up your children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, or a church member who has vowed to assist parents in this endeavor, let us all be praying for our covenant children, living examples of faith before them, getting to know them personally, and doing what we can, things like serving in nursery or teaching Sunday school or assisting in youth ministry, doing things to make sure that it will not be said of us at Covenant Presbyterian Church, another generation arose after them who did not know the Lord nor the work which He had done for His people.